Okay, welcome to another morning on this 2009 Penang retreat. And even though I've mentioned so many things about meditation, there's always a few more things to mention. Some of these things which you have heard before on previous retreats, some will be new to you. But even if it's something you've heard before, every time I talk about these things, I always add a little bit more to deepen the understanding of the path of meditation. And one of the very beautiful similes which I've given for meditation, which not only describe the process of meditation, but also make very clear the path of meditation and why it works, is that simile of the thousand-petal lotus. And for those of you who haven't heard that simile before, you'll notice that a lotus is a very strong symbol of Buddhism. And you'll find lotuses on the covers of Buddhist books. You'll find them on stained glass windows. And you may even know that some time ago there was even a computer company called Lotus. And that was actually run by a Buddhist who used the lotus as a name for his company in the United States. So lotus has been a very strong symbol of Buddhism from the early ages. And one of those symbols of a lotus is the symbol of the thousand-petal lotus. And I'm sure you've seen lotus in the parks and gardens of a place like Penang. And you may also notice that the lotus is closed up at night. So at night time, the lotus is a very tight bud. And in the early morning, when the sun comes out, when it warms the outermost layer of that lotus, the lotus begins to open up. And when it opens up, it can reveal the next layer of petals just inside the outermost ones. And when they can receive the sun, they too open up to reveal the second layer of petals, so that can receive the sun, and that too opens up. The layers of petals open up one after the other in sequence. And with a lotus, the outermost layer of petals is always rough and coarse, because that has to withstand the wind, the rain, and the dust. And inside that very coarse, rough, dirty outermost petal, you find these very beautiful, refined petals. In fact, the deeper you go into the lotus, the more beautiful, the more fragrant, the more delicate are those petals. And as the sun warms the lotus more and more layers of petal open up and open up and open up, revealing deeper and deeper into the heart of the lotus. And for those of you who haven't heard this simile before, there is the most famous mantra in Vajrayana Buddhism, the Om Mani Padme Hum. And I know maybe that you have chanted that before, or you've gone to other temples and saw other people chanting that mantra, but how many of you know what it means? Sometimes, this is what I was saying about superstition the other night, we can chant all these things and we don't know what it means. Sometimes, I've threatened, I haven't done it yet, but probably one day I will. When we do the chanting in Pali, sometimes I threaten to do the funeral chanting in Pali at a marriage service. And no one would know what I was chanting, because they would think, oh, the monk is chanting, it must mean for a happy marriage, and I'm chanting the opposite. But nevertheless, people think, oh, the monk's chanting, it must be lucky. So you don't know what I'm chanting. But when we chant Om Mani Padme Hum, it actually means the last word and the first and last words are just the same as Namo. We say Namo Tassa, it just means homage. It's like a sadhu. And the two most important words are the Mani Padme. The other ones are just almost fillers. And Mani Padme means the jewel in the heart of the lotus. Mani is the jewel, Padme is the locative of the lotus. So it literally means like homage or praise or sadhu to the jewel in the heart of the lotus, sadhu. So what is the jewel in the heart of the lotus? Now you can get back to my simile of a lotus opening up leaf by leaf, petal by petal, as you go deeper into the heart of the lotus. And in the middle of that lotus, according to this simile, is this priceless jewel, right in the middle, the heart of the lotus. And so your job to get that priceless jewel is to open up the lotus, petal by petal, layer by layer, until you get to the very heart, the center of the lotus, and see the jewel in the heart of the lotus. Now what that means in practice, you know what the lotus is? You. You are the lotus. And the sun which comes up early in the morning is your mindfulness and compassion. The two join together, mindfulness and compassion. And so what happens? With mindfulness and compassion you shine it on this body and mind. You sit down and close your eyes and shine mindfulness and compassion inside. And what happens? The sloth and torpor and the dullness, the restlessness, this coarse outermost layer of you slowly opens up. It opens up to reveal the beautiful layer of petals inside of you. When you have something like present moment awareness, you're going inside of your body and mind. You're going inside of time to this beautiful present moment. And how do you do that? You just shine mindfulness and compassion on whatever you're experiencing right now. And it opens up. And this is the experience when you first start meditating. It might be boring. It might not be all that pleasant. But as your lotus opens up, the petals actually are quite beautiful. The outermost isn't beautiful. When it starts opening, you start going inside. It's beautiful, fragrant, and very delicate. So there you have the beautiful petals of present moment awareness, just being here right now. So how do you go to the next stage? You just shine more mindfulness and compassion on the present moment. And in its own time, according to nature, according to cause and effect, that layer of petals called present moment awareness opens out to reveal what's inside the present moment. And you know what that is called? Silence. The mind becomes so still and so beautiful and so powerful because that's the layer of petals inside the present moment awareness. Now the reason I love this simile is because you don't do anything to get from one stage to the next. You just stay with the stage you're already on and go deeper into it. So in order to get silence, you just stay with the present moment and go deeper and deeper and deeper into the present moment. As if there's a present moment, a layer of petals, and it opens out. And you see right inside the present moment is the silence. And so you just stay with the silence. You don't do anything. You just shine your mindfulness and compassion on the silence. And in its own time, that opens out to reveal your breathing, the feeling of the breath. And if you do it this way, you'll find when that layer of petals of silence opens out and you see this breath, it's always very beautiful and subtle. But then, you're just watching the breath go in, go out, go in, go out. And soon, just by shining mindfulness and compassion on this breath, that too opens out to reveal the next layer of petals inside the breath petal. and that we call the delightful breath. And here those layer of petals are very beautiful and deliciously fragrant, and they are quite subtle. Sometimes when you first get to even that stage of the delightful breath, it might be too subtle for people, and they think there's nothing there to watch. They wonder, what should I do? The answer is, do nothing. Just keep shining your mindfulness and compassion, and you find that so-called nothingness is this delightful, beautiful breath. A little bit different than the breath you've known before, but still, it is the breath, only very subtle and very peaceful and very beautiful. Because that's right inside the ordinary breath. All you need to do is to shine compassion and mindfulness and just wait for it to open up. And then you're watching this beautiful, delightful breath. And what you need to do is just carry on as before, mindfulness and compassion. That is the sun warming everything. And after a while, it opens up, and as it opens up, it reveals the next layer of petals. And that's a brilliant layer of petals. That's called the nimitta. And that lies right within the beautiful breath. Now I'll pause here for a minute, because there's a problem which people have when they first experience nimittas. And that problem is that once a nimitta arises, sometimes it's not that stable. And people think, should I go back to the breath or should I stay with the nimitta? And it's wonderful to visualize a nimitta as just a layer of petals, but still surrounded by the previous layer, by the breath. So the breath is outside as it were, just holding the nimitta. And you don't know which way to go, whether the petals are going to close up and the nimitta is going to disappear, or whether the petals of the beautiful breath are going to open up to reveal the nimitta fully. It's sort of halfway in between. The breath petals opening up to reveal what's inside it, or the breath petals closing up and you lose the nimitta. But whatever it is, just let nature take its course. Don't do anything. The only thing you can do is to be still and maintain your mindfulness and kindness on what you're experiencing. And after a while, all that happens is the beautiful breath, it does fully open. And that reveals the nimitta, and it stays there. Now remember, the deeper you go inside the lotus, the more delightful, beautiful, amazing are those layers of petals. And this is a very, very refined layer of petals, incredibly fragrant, beautiful, blissful. And so you have a nimitta there, and what do? Again, absolutely nothing. Don't try and control or work with any lights in the mind. It doesn't matter what color they are. Just keep shining the mindfulness and compassion until that layer of petals again opens up. And as it opens up more and more, you will find So as the layer of petals opens up more and more, you will find that inside that outermost layer of layer of petals causes a delightful breath. As you're just watching the nimitta layer of petals, you find that will open up, and inside the nimitta, that's where you find this first jhana. It's right inside the nimitta. So you don't have to get rid of anything to go on to the next stage. Every time it's you go deeper into the stage you're experiencing now. So you go in the nimitta and you go into that nimitta to find the first jhana. And a lot of time this is how people experience the transition from a nimitta, this beautiful light, into a jhana. You've got this beautiful light, very powerful, very still, and you feel yourself either falling into the center of it or the thing enveloping you, just like the layer of petals just opens up and you go into the center. Now by this time, with the first jhana, you really are experiencing something wonderful and profound. Here again, your body has disappeared, you can't hear any sounds. And what are you aware of in the jhana? Just incredible bliss. And my marketing slogan, to make it very interesting for each one of you, is that this is a bliss better than sex. And when I mention that, very many people are interested. I'm just being down to earth about what people are interested in life. And sometimes people say, well, can lay people get into these stages? And of course, yes. And the reason why I say it's a bliss better than sex is one of the first times I got into these beautiful stages of meditation was when I was still a student. And I had a girlfriend, and you know, I'm being honest with everybody, that I slept with her. And I left her in the town of Gloucester and went off to a retreat, and a few days later had this beautiful meditation. And I compared it. Which was better, having the meditation or sleeping with your girlfriend? And actually, there was no comparison. The meditation was much better. And that really shocked me. What I remember afterwards, I think, why has no one told me about this before? You can have much more fun in meditation than with a girlfriend. And that's only the start. So now that's what you've got to look forward to if you get into these meditations. This is going to blow you away. This is real big time bliss and ecstasy. But it's not just for the sake of the pleasure of it. It's for the sake of understanding why was that so powerfully blissful. Because sometimes people complain, this path of jhana is just samatha. It's just making the mind peaceful. You're not getting any insight out of this. My goodness, you're getting huge amounts of insight from the experience. This is very, very powerful ecstasy and bliss. And why? And the reason is because when you enter one of these stages, you just let go of a whole heap of suffering. Imagine you've been to the shopping mall. And you've got all of these bags and bags of goods which you're taking home. And you're carrying them through the streets of Penang. And by the time you get home, your arms are aching, your shoulders hurt, and you're so tired. And by the time you get home, you're in pain. But you're home, so you put the bags down. Ah, that's such a relief. This multiplied a million times is the joy of jhana. You've been carrying around these heavy burdens, not just for the past 1 hour, but since the time you were born. And you don't realize how tired you are. And you find this wonderful path of meditation, and you put down that burden. Oh, what a relief. That is the bliss of the first jhana. The bliss of renunciation. The bliss caused by putting aside these five senses and with it the body. Your body aches. It's a constant irritation. You're always moving your knees or scratching your face or moving your feet or nodding your head or scratching your toes or scratching your ear. I've just been describing what I've been looking at, what you've been doing in the last 30 seconds. None of you can stay still. You know why? Because your body is always irritating. Scratching your arm. Scratching your cheek again. Whatever it is. Our body is totally irritating. But you know what? We've got used to it. We don't notice it anymore. We just scratch, we just move, we swallow, we touch our nose. We're always doing this, but we take it for granted. We don't realize what an irritating thing this body is. But when we get into jhanas, the five senses in the body have been totally dropped. Like these five heavy bags we've been carrying around. My goodness, that's a relief. So only then you realize what the Buddha said, that the body is dukkha, and these five senses are suffering. You don't know that until you've dropped them. And it's such a relief, it's such a freedom. It's like going out of a prison. I'm free! And that's the experience of bliss in the first jhana. So not only do you experience incredible pleasure, but you can't help by asking yourself, why? And this is actually what you find out. And of course, so you're in this first jhana, incredible bliss, because you've dropped the body. This amazing layer of petals, which you've never seen before, which actually very few people see. The most amazing, beautiful thing you've ever experienced in your life. And then what happens? Just with mindfulness and compassion, you've been doing this automatically, you can't stop now. And that layer of petals called the first jhana opens up to reveal this incredible layer of petals called the second jhana. Even more beautiful, even more profound and subtle, the second jhana. And you know what's been dropped there? As I said the other day, what's been dropped there is your will. Your ability to choose, to do things. All your likes and dislikes have disappeared. And the way Ajahn Chah described it, he said it's like a person who's been born with a rope around their neck. And that rope is being pulled tight by two invisible demons. And it's always been tight around your neck, so it's hard to breathe. And one demon is called like, and the other demon is called dislike. And that's been choking you all your life. You like some things, you dislike other things. Stops you being free. And now, in this deep meditation state, those demons have let the rope go. I can breathe at last. I'm again free, and it's such a relief not to have any likes or dislikes. No more I want to do, no more I don't want to do. Where all the will and the craving which have irritated you more than your body have now stopped. And that becomes the bliss of the second jhana, an even deeper layer of petals. What do you do next? You know, we're only started on this journey. The best is yet to come. And sometimes when you're on this journey, you can't believe, surely there can't be anything more than this. And that's a problem for some people. Because some people, they get into one of these jhanas and they think they're enlightened. Quite understandably so. But there's more to come yet. And inside that second jhana, unbelievably so, there's a third jhana that layer of petals opens out, and in its middle a very, very refined layer of petals. It's just taking happiness to a totally different level, because before that, what we thought as happiness had been tainted by this thing we call pity. Now I'm getting too difficult to describe what these things are like. You have to experience them. But in that third jhana, there's something missing. Every time you've been happy, in joy, there's been something there which gave it a sour edge, and that's been taken away. And you're in this incredibly beautiful third jhana. And eventually, those petals open up too, and you go into this fourth jhana. More peaceful than you could ever imagine. absolutely still. For those of you who have been aspiring for peace of mind, this is where you know how deep peace of mind can become. In this very, very deep state of stillness, not blanking out, but super aware, each of these stages of meditation, you're going further and further away from dullness. It's like you really are waking up now. It's as if that what you thought you were awake, you were really asleep. Now your mindfulness is super strong, fully aware, but not moving, experiencing the deepest of peace. So a person in fourth jhana, they ask afterwards, what was I aware of? And the answer will be, peace. The deepest peace I've ever known. That still is not the jewel in the heart of the lotus yet. Because there's a few more petals to open up. And these are just the most refined and subtle petals. This is what we call the immaterial states. Because as that fourth jhana layer of petals opens up, inside we see the end of space. Where we talk about space, we talk about space, and sometimes people say it's infinite, sometimes it's nothing at all. If you can understand that, similar to present moment awareness, this is the best simile I can give to allow people who haven't experienced these states to understand them. In present moment awareness, once you're meditating, you go into this now. There's no time at all. There's no past, there's no future, because you're in the now. What time means? Time means a distance between the past and the future, between the past and the present, or the present and the future. It is only the present. There's no more time. And also, for those people who experience present moment awareness, and some of you have, you meditate for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, half an hour, and it is timeless. You can't notice the passage of time. It's like you have all the time in the world. And one of the same experience. There's no time, an infinity of time. It's time not measurable. Now if you understand that concept, you understand why the first immaterial state is space, unmeasurable, both infinite and nothing at the same time. Space is disappearing. And you go into the next layer of petals. Consciousness disappearing. The state, they call it infinite consciousness. I prefer unbounded or unmeasured consciousness, where consciousness, just like in the present moment, where time disappears, in this state, consciousness is disappearing. The knowing is vanishing. Now that's a very subtle layer of petals. But that's still not the end. Because that opens up. And what's inside? Nothing. The great emptiness. Even nothing is now disappearing. Now, of course, you get into such refined states, you have to experience these to get a handle on them. These are like petals which aren't petals. And this is standard Theravada Buddhism. And sometimes you think, my goodness, Ajahn Brahm is talking about Zen. He's starting to mention emptiness, that's Mahayana. Look, there is no difference between these great vehicles. Just different ways of describing the same events. As you go into the next layer of petals, inside nothingness, You think that's impossible, but there is something inside nothingness. And that's his state of neither perception nor non-perception. Where, if you look at it from the observer, you're perceiving something, and the object, nothing there. Depends on from which angle either perception is working, at the other angle it's stopped already. Perception, the last function of your consciousness, is about to turn off. That is the last layer of petals. The innermost layer is about to open up. And inside the last layer of petals, there you find the jewel in the heart of the lotus. The thing about which the Tibetans say, Om Mani Padme Hum. Worship that jewel in the heart of the lotus. And you know what that is? You find out for yourself. Of course you have to find out for yourself. You can say nothing, you can say emptiness, you can say nirvana, but what does that mean for you anyway? Now, the great thing about that simile, which I've described at the very end, is that jewel in the heart of the lotus is in the lotus all the time. Enlightenment is right in the center of you in this moment. And your job is just to uncover it, to allow all these different layers of your body and mind to open out, to reveal what's inside, and for that to open out, to reveal what's inside that, and for that to open out, until you go deeper and deeper and deeper into what you already are experiencing. So you don't need to move to anything else. Imagine that sun shining on the lotus, and a cloud comes across. So the sun goes out. And what happens to the lotus? It starts closing up again. All you need to do is stay with your mindfulness. A cloud coming across is like you're restless. You go with it to something else. What should I do next? Let's go try some other method of meditation. No, you stay with what you're experiencing now. And you stay there long enough with patience. It has to open up. So that's what I say, even with dullness. Stay with the dullness. Make peace with it. Be gentle, be kind. You stay with dullness long enough, it has to open up to see what's in the middle of it. You don't need to get rid of it. Just go deep inside of it. You get present moment awareness. You don't need to do anything to say, now I should watch the breath, or now I should do metta meditation. Go deeper into the present moment. Inside the present moment is silence, breath, beautiful breath, nimittas, jhanas, enlightenment. It's right in the middle of what you're having right now. So the path of meditation is never going on to another stage. It's never going on to the next stage of meditation. It's always going in and in and in to the next stage of meditation. Always remember that, and then you have a great advantage in meditation. You know what I have to do? Stay where I am and go deeper into it. Go deeper into the present moment, deeper into the silence, deeper into the breath, and when a nimitta comes, deeper into the nimitta. And that's all you need to do. That means that simile of the lotus is actually showing you what happens and what to expect. After a while, as you go deeper into this moment, it gets more beautiful, more delightful, more powerful, and unfortunately more exciting and more fearful. It has to happen. But those of you who get afraid because these things are incredibly powerful states of mind. Please feel reassured that even the Buddha felt afraid before his enlightenment. It says in the Mahasatika Sutta, this is the Bodhisattva before he became fully enlightened, saying, why am I afraid of those jhana states which have nothing to do with unwholesome things? Even the Buddha was afraid. Why? Because they're very, very powerful. Immense bliss and happiness. And sometimes, I'll just give you some personal reflections. Sometimes I've sat there in meditation and wondered, how on earth can a human being take so much ecstasy? I thought that you can't do this anymore, you're going to explode. But one thing I found, you can always take some more bliss. It's good for you. So this is what's going to happen. Sometimes people ask me, Ajahn Brahm, why are you a monk? You've got a good degree from a good university, you're fit, you know, I can administer things like monasteries, I can build monasteries, I've got many skills. Why don't you use those skills for something else? Go and start a company, get married, have kids, watch movies. Why are you a monk? Now perhaps you know, because you can bliss out in deep ecstasies. If you could do that, would you be interested in movies and other stuff? Of course not. So, this is for you. In the time of the Buddha, lay people did this. Why can't you do it now? The most important thing is knowing how it's done. Just go deeper and deeper in. So as you go deeper in, it's more ecstasy, more fun, but more profound as well. Every stage gives you more and more insights, more and more understanding into the nature of your body and your mind. Because how can you understand what your body is until you've let it go and almost like look at it from a distance? How can you understand what your mind is until you've let it go and understand it from a distance? These are the states where you get insight and wisdom. But you do have fear because they're very powerful. You do get excited because they're very enjoyable. But don't worry. A lot of times that excitement and that fear are just overcome naturally without having to do anything, without having to have strategies. Simply what happens is, as far as fear is concerned, yeah, it looks powerful. You don't know whether you can handle it or not, but my goodness, it looks delightful. So it's like you're looking through the door. And inside it's just so much fun, but it's a bit scary. But it's so much joy, but you're a bit afraid. But it looks so wonderful, but who cares, I'm going. That's what happens. It's the bliss, the joy pulls you in past fear. You can't resist it. That's what happens. So don't worry about the fear. After a while, just the whole momentum of meditation will just push you past it. And as for excitement, yeah, you blow it a couple of times because you get excited. A nice nimittoya, you're about to go in the jhana, and you get excited. But don't worry, because after a while, your mind will say, look, I'm not going to blow it a third time. This time I'm really going to relax and go for it. And you can hold your mind still just for those few seconds to overcome the excitement and go straight in. And once you're in, oh, this is nice. Ooh, this is wonderful. I'm so glad I'm a Buddhist and can enjoy these states. And these are states which you don't have to believe in. These are your own personal experience. So you know what the Buddha taught and you know why he taught it. So the whole purpose of being a Buddhist is not to learn the teachings, but to experience them. Not to just be able to write a book about liberation, but be able to liberate yourself. To be able to understand what the Buddha felt. For your own experience. I was very fortunate. even my first meditation teacher when I was a student at Cambridge. He taught jhanas, and I was only a student. I remember him saying, he said, "The reason I teach you is just so you can get into a first jhana. That's all I want you to achieve. You get into such a state, my job would have been done, and you'd have tasted something wonderful, some real Dhamma." That was his goal, and really that's why I teach as well. So each one of you can taste the bliss of freedom. Just one experience, even a short time. So you understand why we have monks and nuns, why we have Buddhism, why the Buddha became enlightened sitting under a tree, not reading a book. And why when I go to schools in Australia and people go asking me, "Well, in Christianity we have the Bible, in Islam they have the Quran, what is the holy book of Buddhism?" And I always answer, meditation. That's the holy book of Buddhism. It's not a book written on paper, but a book which is written in your heart. Not something which you can put on the internet, on Google Books, but something. Google Books is where they try and put all the books on Google so people can read them for free. No, it's all I'm pretty up to date sometimes. No, it's written in the deepest of meditations, there in your heart. And that's what we really want to read. What is peace? What is freedom? What is joy? So there you become a real Buddhist. So that is a simile of the thousand petal lotus. It shows you what's going to happen. And my goodness, it's fun. You've got a lot of happiness and joy and bliss and freedom to look forward to. And some of you might think, "Well, yeah, maybe if you're born, you know, as a meditator like Ajahn Brahm was, maybe, you know, that if you've been a monk in your past life or a nun in your past life, but me," you might think, "no, I would never do these things." Remember, in the heart of every lotus is the jewel. Surrounding that jewel in the innermost layers are these jhanas. Even if you look at a lotus and on the outside it doesn't look very promising, you look at Angulimala, a serial killer. You look at Patachara, a psychotic, totally mad. You look at Bada, the hunchback. You look at, what was her name, the prostitute, the Ambapali, the prostitute. You look at all these people from all the different walks of life. People who had far more obstacles than you have. They managed to become enlightened. They managed to open up their lotus. So if they can do it, can't you? Are there any serial killers in the audience? Are there any psychotics like Patachara, totally out of her skull? They managed to do it. So surely you can. And all you need to do is shine that mindfulness and compassion on whatever you are, and it all opens up. The prostitute, the street sweeper, the dwarf, that's only the outermost layers. It's the innermost layers are the important ones. In Mahayana we always say everyone has got Buddha nature. That's true. Everyone's got the jewel inside of themselves. And our job in meditation is to open ourselves out. Let go of the outermost to get the innermost. Let go of the innermost to get even more inner. Until there's nothing left. So, next time you're meditating, you sit down there, I am a lotus. I am a beautiful lotus inside, even though the outside looks pretty mucky and yucky. But inside is something really wonderful. And allow that to all open out just by shining the sun of mindfulness and compassion continuously on this moment. Restlessness, sloth and torpor, craziness, psychosis, you think you're going out of your skull. Just be mindful and compassionate of that. Don't fight. Make peace. Be kind. Be gentle. And you'll experience your lotus opening and opening and opening. That's the path of meditation. The inward path. The path of discovery. What's right in the center of each one of you. So, any questions or comments about the lotus simile? Ah, yes. The difference between Hinduism and Buddhism, they too, eventually they started believing in jhanas, but in the beginning they didn't. It was they took them on from the Buddha. But I don't know too much, but I remember one young man who was a disciple of one of the great Hindu teachers, Swami Muktananda. And he was telling me about his meditation practice, and he was saying that their practice was to get this nimitta, which they called the blue pearl nimitta. So I've already mentioned to you, the colors are not important, but they were trying to get this very deep, pearly blue color nimitta. And one of these meditators, they said they got it, but only for a short time. And they said in their system that once you absorbed into that blue pearl nimitta, then you were a saint. You'd finished. Here, we just call that first jhana. So really, that many of you, you've chosen the wrong religion. You should be in Hinduism because you can become a saint much more easy. That's only a joke. But it is true, because once you get into that absorption, some of the characteristics of this is you are so gone. A lot of time people think they've disappeared, there's no self left. And number two, you've got this incredible, powerful bliss which you've merged into. So in Hinduism and also Christianity, if you experience even that first jhana, you come out afterwards and you would say that was union with God. You disappeared and your union with this powerful, immense, blissful force. You're just one with love. So other people call it. But as a Buddhist, you realize, oh yeah, just first jhana. There's much more to come. And that's really the difference. Without trying to be superior to any other religion, it is the understanding of the levels of meditation in the mind are far more refined in our Buddhist tradition than any other tradition. So we go much deeper. We let go further than that first jhana. Does that sort of answer the question? There's another question over there, yeah? Yeah, so you do the right thing, you go deep, 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 and you go all the way in. A natural process. It is very much a natural process. And after a while, once you become a skilled meditator, your job is just to make sure you don't interfere with the process. Basically, you don't do anything. Now that seems a bit strange, because people, yesterday they asked a good question. Well, if that's the case, what about things like right effort, which is one of the factors of the Eightfold Path? Here's Ajahn Brahm coming along saying, just do absolutely nothing. But you'll find that many of the great teachers also said that. I remember Ajahn Chah, the first year I was with him in his monastery in Thailand, he said something which was totally off the wall. It was just totally ridiculous. It made no sense to me at all. He said, Wat Bapong, his monastery, was a mango orchard. And he said, the mango trees have been planted by the Buddha himself. And he said, this is Ajahn Chah speaking, he said, these mango trees are now mature and they're dripping with ripe mangoes. So delicious. And he said, you monks these days don't have to do anything. You don't have to climb the trees to get the mangoes. You don't have to throw sticks up to get the mangoes. You monks, all you need to do is to open your hand and a mango will fall into it. And that's what he said. And I thought, that is ridiculous. You know, I went out there to open my hand and no mango fell. If it did fall, it fell over there, not in my hand. What the heck was he talking about? And of course, now you understand what he was talking about. You know, the tree is the Dhamma. The mangoes, you know, the jhanas, enlightenment. Said, you don't need to climb the tree or throw sticks up to get these experiences. All you need to do is to open the door of your heart, open your hand, and keep it open. And the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, all enlightenment, they just fall right into your hand. If you try climbing the tree, you never get any mangoes. If you throw sticks up, no way will you get any mangoes. Thank you. Do you understand? It's that wonderful effort of stopping, of restraining, of learning how to do absolutely nothing, so that you mindfulness and compassion just continue to shine without moving. And it is natural. When the sun continues to shine, the lotus keeps opening. So does that answer your question? Yeah. If you experience the jhanas, we become capable of entering the stream. You are increasing your chances immensely of entering the stream. So if you've got a jhana, you have to be very dumb not to enter the stream. Because it's right in front of you. However, I should add that in order to enter the stream, it's not just having the jhanas. It's also having a bit of understanding of what the Buddha taught, which is the difference, as you said earlier, between, say, a Christian or a Hindu achieving a jhana and a Buddhist achieving a jhana. Because a Hindu or a Christian will think that that's God and their union with the divine, because they have a God idea. If you have the Dharma of the Buddha, teachings such as Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Anicca Dukkha Anatta, then when you get into that jhana and you come out afterwards, you will see that experience in the framework of the Buddha's teachings. Well, the Buddha actually said that where there is wisdom and jhana, when they get together, that's where you're in the presence of Nibbana. Verse 372 of the Dhammapada. Nati jhanang apanyasa, panya nati ajayato, yam hi jhanang cha panya cha sawe nibbana santike. I don't know much Pali which I can recite off the top of my head, but there is those phrases which I learned because they're just so wonderful. It means there is no jhana without wisdom. You know, you have to learn how to let go and understand what letting go is. That's why I have to teach. You won't get those jhanas otherwise. Nati jhana apanyasa. There is no jhana for one without wisdom. Panya nati ajayato. There's no wisdom without jhanas. Yam hi jhanang cha panya cha. But in the one who has jhanas and wisdom, the two together, satve nibbana santike, they are in the presence of nibbana. They're knocking on the door. They've got the two keys. So the chances of you getting into seeing Nibbana, getting to be a stream winner, are very great. If you're missing one of those, if you've got jhana but no wisdom, you haven't really studied or understood the Buddha's teachings, you're going to miss out. If you've got all the wisdom, you're a professor of Buddhism, You know, you can translate from Pali to Chinese to Sanskrit to English, but you've had no jhana, still you can't become enlightened. You need the two together. And as Malays and Buddhists, I'm very impressed that you have very good wisdom. You go to Dharma schools, you go to lectures, you've got a huge number of books. So you have all of the knowledge, the wisdom. The thing which is missing is the jhanas. You put that in there, the two together, something's going to happen. So yeah, you need the both there. And the thing which is missing is the deep meditations of jhanas. Does that answer your question? Any other questions? Yeah? Do you need all the eight jhanas? No, you don't need all the eight jhanas. Even one jhana is sufficient according to what the Buddha taught. However, the more jhanas, the better. In other words, the more power, the more you're increasing your chances. One lottery ticket is enough to win the lotto. If you have eight or nine, you're increasing your chances. Yes. Did the Buddha say anything specific on meditation? He was speaking about meditation all the time. All about letting go, about sort of abandoning things, about, what is it, the 11 doors into enlightenment in the Ataka Nagara Sutta. Because someone asked Ananda, sort of, how many ways are there to become enlightened? And Ananda said, well, 11 ways. And those were the four jhanas, the four Brahma-vihara jhanas, jhanas based on metta, mudita, upeka, and karuna, and the three immaterial jhanas. The fourth immaterial jhana, the nevasanya nasanya, neither perception nor non-perception, he says that's too subtle to use as a platform for enlightenment. It's just far, far too subtle. Everything else, yes. And those were the 11 ways, all based on jhanas. So Buddha kept on talking about that. He said, again, it was Ananda was asked by a person just after the Buddha died, what type of meditation did the Buddha praise? This is the Gopaka Moggallana Sutta. What type of meditation did the Buddha teach and praise? And Ananda said, only four types of meditation. What were those four? First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. It's all about meditation, jhana, jhana, jhana. So it's great that you read those suttas for yourself. They're in the library, and they've got very good English translations. I'm sure they're good Chinese translations as well. You can read them in the Agamas, you know, in the Chinese Mahayana versions. They're pretty much the same, all giving the same teachings. That's actually one thing, interestingly, historically, I've noticed in the last 20 or 30 years, especially Mahayana and Theravada, we're coming so close together. It's almost like we were brothers separated by many thousands of miles, separated by history and geography. And now when we're coming close together, we see we share so much that we are real brothers and sisters. So the separation between Mahayana and Theravada, it's just disintegrating, you know, in our lifetimes, which is a wonderful thing to see. Yes. The kindness and compassion. One thing with the kindness and compassion, it doesn't judge that this is good enough, or this is bad, I want more. So one of the troubles with our meditation, we're always judging. Yeah, I've got nimittas, but it's not good enough, I want jhanas. What loving kindness. Have you got children? Do you love them? Of course you do. It'd be great if they were doctors, if they were surgeons, if they were millionaires, and they all got married to really wonderful wives and husbands, but you just love them anyway. And that degree of like loving a person, no matter who they are, is another great form of letting go. Real love, real compassion. As I said in my book, the door of my heart is open to you, no matter who you are, no matter what you do. In my stupid mind, I'm tired. Nevertheless, I love you, mind. You can go and sleep. Go on. With that degree of compassion, you're not forcing anything. You're not fighting. You're accepting everything with 100% love. So that when you do that with compassion on this lotus, you're accepting this lotus petal. You can open up if you want. You don't have to if you don't want to. I love you anyway. A total unconditional awareness. Not asking anything. And that means it's an attitude. You're being aware, but you're not interfering. So don't forget compassion. It's not just a fun thing to do. It's an essential part of the path. Without it, you never get into jhanas. And sometimes, being a teacher and watching students develop their meditation, you can see that some people do it really well and they get very deep very quickly. Some people take more time. And after a while, being a teacher, you start to get to know that the people are really kind and compassionate. They're the ones who go very fast. It's just their nature. The ones who are very fault-finding, they're always telling you off, you're not sitting right, you know, you should be sitting in that place, sitting this place, you know, you're making too much noise when you're eating. All those people who find fault, they're the ones who have a very difficult time getting into meditation. So, be kind to each other on this retreat. When someone starts speaking, don't say, shut up. Bad yogi. Bad yogi. You never get into meditation that way. So be kind. If someone's talking a lot, oh, it must be going through a hard time. If they're sleeping a lot, oh, poor thing, they must be tired. If they have to eat a lot, oh, poor thing, they must be hungry. So don't be fault-finding, be kind. And you develop that compassion, you'll find your meditation takes off. Okay, so now is the time for interviews. If you have any more questions, here's the box for the questions. And there'll be another talk this evening. So, remember, 1,000 petal lotus gives you a great simile of what you're doing here, just opening out. Open, open, open. And the deeper you go, the more fun it gets. Thank you for listening.